discuss how can the UK environmental sector contribute to green growth. So let me explain the order of play. Over the next 15 minutes or so, each of our four panellists is going to speak for a few minutes each. Then I will ask them a few questions. Then you're all welcome to come in and ask questions via the Q&A function, which I will then select and read out. We'll have a back and forth and a discussion among the panel. And then at about 8:15, we'll close. Now, just before I start, for reasons that will not be mysterious, no doubt to any of you, George Eustace, the Secretary of State, has been very slightly delayed. So we're going to start without him. And without any more ado, I'm going to turn at once to Sue Biggs, Director General of the Royal Horticultural Association, who will speak to us now, and welcome.
Thank you very much, Paul. And as you say, I'm Sue Biggs and I'm Director General of the Royal Horticultural Society and also Chair of the Ornamental Horticulture Roundtable Group that we'll come on to talk about. I spent 30 years in the travel industry and then 11 years ago joined the RHS. And since then, we've hopefully made it more open, more accessible, more charitably and commercially successful. And I hope and believe that we can help the government and work together to really achieve the government's economic and social sustainability targets. So, quick commercial break for the RHS, just of my background. It's been in existence for over 200 years, and we've recently grown substantially to over 600,000 members. So, quick hint, makes a good focus group if ever you need any help on that. And we have over 30 million web users as well. We've got five gardens, including Wisley and our brand new garden up in Bridgewater in Salford, as well as we run shows like Chelsea Flower Show. We have army of research scientists. We have educational RHS qualifications, campaign school gardening, community outreach work like Britain in Bloom. So we try and do everything we can to invest back into the charity and generate healthy surpluses. And that's towards the 30 million people there are now, partially as a result of COVID. The number of gardeners went up by 3 million. So 30 million gardeners in this country, and the land that they garden covers literally twice the size of Somerset. So I guess for both James and I, we both get frustrated quite often that horticulture is seen as the poor relation to agriculture and the countryside. So that's how one of the reasons why we created the Ornamental Horticulture Roundtable Group. It came about in 2014 from a discussion that we were having with the then Secretary of State at DEFRA. And really, we were talking about how we might best get the respect of government for ornamental horticulture and landscaping, which is the industry that we're talking about, because we do contribute as much as fisheries and almost as much as farming to the economic, environmental and social health of our country. As a result of that, we formed a cross-industry group that represents ornamental and environmental horticulture. And really, that also included the landscaping industry that inevitably goes together with it. So it's a very broad and varied sector, and it includes commercial growers, private and public gardens, garden centres, arboriculture, domestic and civic landscaping, and it's nationwide. And it's a very varied, it's British-based multinationals, but also family-based businesses, independent, multi-generational families right across in every corner of the country. I think the government's been really admirable of post-Brexit and post-COVID, or at least we hope post-COVID, that the government ambitions are high for economic growth, achieving environmental biodiversity and climate change targets, and also delivering the levelling up agenda, and also trying to solve all of the particularly mental health crises that have been since COVID. And it is true to say that the horticulture industry can help solve all of those things. So as a result of our desire at OHRG to really try and be able to prove to government the importance of our industry, in 2017, we commissioned a report through Oxford Economics to it sounds slightly embarrassing to say for the first time ever, established the size of the industry. But that's what we did with that report. And the industry generated over 24 billion into UK GDP, almost 570,000 jobs and 5.4 billion in tax payments. But that wasn't really enough. So last year we had the second major report, which is called Growing a Green Economy from OHRG. And we believe that we've got the potential to grow to 42 billion. We can add another, that's 18 million over the first report, an extra 100,000 jobs and generate 8.7 billion in tax revenues to the country, as well as help mitigate the worst effects of climate change and help improve the nation's health and well-being. So we added to that of unlocking green growth is the supplementary action plan that goes with it, because just whinging at government doesn't do any good. And in that report that some of you may see, I think you had the link to it, you may have seen there that all of us who are a member of OHRG, which includes the RHS and HTA, outline what policy changes are needed and how industry and government could work much more closely together to deliver the benefits that we believe we can. There were four areas: delivering a Brexit premium trade-wise, developing urban community renewal, really making sure that we expand the employment opportunities in the sector and deliver a sustainable future. So we are really in return for what we as an active can-do industry want to get is to be recognised and supported as a valuable industry by government. There are all sorts, and I think I won't go into too much detail about the hope for the future, because I think there is so much that could come. But there are three committees, and our research, this is at OHRG, our research and development committee recognises that climate change is the defining crisis of our age. At the same time as that, and aided and abetted by it, of course, our plants are under increasing and unprecedented threats from new pests and diseases. We've got to do something about climate change. Our Education Skills Committee is determined to do something about the increasing green skills crisis and want to see horticulture is missing totally from our schools and colleges. And, well, from the Commercial Committee, you're going to hear all about that from James. So I can only add to the only thing I will say about on the commercial side is I come from the commercial world. I come from the travel industry, and we ignore our peril. I think the omission of promoting British garden tourism. Gardening is the exporting of our gardening design, landscaping and science knowledge around the world. I think it's a huge missed opportunity for UK PLC. And I think one of our challenges is that we don't fit neatly into any one government department. It's DEFRA is our main partner, but what about education or health or BEIS or levelling up and housing communities or DCMS? So we don't have one home, and we want to find a way to generate a secure relationship with government. And it's not major funding at all. In fact, I think James will probably go on to talk about this is minor funding to really deliver and help the government deliver on its green growth agenda. So thank you all very much for listening for my commercial break for the horticulture industry. But I'd now like to hand over, I think, to Lord Eamon, if we're keeping the same order, Paul.
Thank you very much. Actually, at this point, if nobody minds, I think before we lose him, I'm going to bring in the Secretary of State, who I hope has unclouded his mind from any other business that may be clogging it today, and will be able to address this question of how the sector can contribute to green growth. Just before I do, it's my regular reminder to those who are participating in this event that do send in questions via Q&A, and we will get round to them. So, Secretary of State, it's over to you.
Thank you, Paul. And I'm here, I think, for the duration, so don't worry, I'm not going to run off. Everything's all under control, you understand. So there's nothing for me to do at the moment. But look, just on this key question, it's increasingly the case, I think, that nature-based solutions and nature-based tourism and nature-based services is incredibly important as an industry, and it's growing. It's already estimated of being worth around 22 billion pounds a year annually. And there are three key areas that I think are going to be important as we think about the opportunities for this industry looking forward. The first is we've got huge ambitions on tree planting, a plan to plant 10,000 hectares of trees in England and 30,000 hectares a year across the UK each and every year by the end of this parliament. That's a huge increase, a level of tree planting that we've not even come close to since the early 1970s. And even then, it wasn't done particularly well, and we often planted the wrong trees in the in the wrong place. So there's a great opportunity there for our tree nurseries. There are companies like Majestic in this field, and Oakovers as well, who are growing some of those native growing trees. And we are putting in place some funds to try and support and pump prime that a domestic nursery stock industry, particularly when it comes to those native tree species. The second key area is that we are changing the approach of our agriculture policy quite fundamentally, away from just having arbitrary area-based subsidies, which is what we've had for the last 15 to 20 years, and instead moving towards paying farmers for farming more sustainably, and crucially for making space for nature on their farms. And alongside that, doing something we've not really done previously, not even in the Countryside Stewardship Scheme, which is to support partnership working, where you may get, say, 50 or so farmers in a particular geography, a particular landscape, coming together in a joint venture and working on a joint project. So you can really get the benefits of critical mass with wildlife corridors and doing interventions to make space for nature on a kind of landscape scale, which all the evidence shows is important to success. And when we do that, I think there's going to be a whole new opportunity that opens up for a new type of private sector delivery business. Those are the contractors, if you like, who might end up working for consortia of landowners and farmers to deliver some of those landscape scale projects. And it's something that's quite exciting that we're looking at. I think there's a whole new generation of younger people now leaving college, school, university, who got different values, often want to work in nature, want to work outdoors, want to do something for the environment. And I can see this becoming quite an exciting, new industry and a new space for new entrepreneurs to get involved in. The third area that I think is also relevant is on our food supply. And that is, if we are to maintain our resilience, the resilience of our own domestic food production, which is a crucial component of our food security, as well as plant all these extra trees, which by definition means some land use change, and some land currently down to agriculture going over to, woodland or peatland restoration, as well as potentially adopt a slightly more extensive approach in some landscapes where we have lower input agriculture, less use of fertilizers, more flower-rich meadows and herbal lays and so on. If we are to do that and maintain our food production, we may also need to be trying to support a whole new generation of modern glasshouses, maybe co-located with industrial processes, making use of surplus heat from those, capturing surplus dioxide. There are some really good projects in this space, quite a lot of green capital showing interest in it. Often Dutch foreign direct investors who want to look to the UK to invest in this new generation of glasshouses. And I think that could also be an important new dimension as well that will help us maintain our food production, but to do so in a sustainable way and in a carbon neutral way. And then, the final thing to just say more broadly is just the role as we come out of this pandemic, the role of nature and the natural environment towards really quite simple things like, people's mental health, state of mind, well-being. I think people learnt a lot during the pandemic. Often access to nature and the outdoors was all that they had. I think it's caused a lot of people to reappraise you know, the role of open spaces and nature in their lives. And that's why a big part of what we are trying to do in our Leveling Up agenda is through things like local nature recovery strategies, biodiversity net gain, making sure that nature has a big place in our planning system, and that local authorities take on a leadership role in a way that they've never done on this sort of scale previously. So there's a lot of exciting opportunities with the new policies that we are charting, and I hope that I've managed to set out a few of those for the panel today.
Secretary of State, thank you very much. And I'm now going to go over without any more ado to the independent chairman of the Climate Change Committee, Lord Deepin.
Well, thank you very much. I mean, I start from the position which Sue started, which is that I've been a businessman all my life, except for the 16 years I was a minister. And one of the things about being in business is you soon recognise that most things are uncertain. And you look for those few things that are certain. And one of the things that is certain, maybe a bad certainty, is that climate change is going to get worse. And the second thing that's certain is that the world has signed up to fighting it. Now, of course, they won't do what they say they're going to do, and they'll be behind, and there'll be all sorts of arguments, and we'll have to ratchet things up and all the rest of it. But it is one of those certainties that we are clear about. And that is very useful for business people, because business people have got quite enough uncertainties to deal with. And this is one thing within which they can actually operate. Now, if you're a gardener, and I am a gardener, particularly a vegetable gardener, you have learnt about climate change sometimes before other people, because spring starts 17 days earlier. You know that the blossoms are coming out before the pollinators. You're beginning to see the fact that other certainties of life are changing very significantly. And of course, we're having very much hotter summers, and we're having water that comes down not in sweet, refreshing showers, but absolutely like tropical downpours. We've learned that, and those of us who look after the land in the very direct way that you do as a gardener really have recognised just how tough and real that is. And it will get worse. So in that, you either decide that you give in and allow apocalypse, or you say, I'm going to use it as an opportunity. And that's what Britain has decided to do. And whatever our differences in views, the fact of the matter is that the government has made it quite clear that this is where the growth will come. And that isn't in any way controversial, in the sense that the biggest area of growth over the last 10 years has been in the green area, that the new jobs have come there. And indeed, my fundamental worry is that the jobs will be there and we won't have the people skilled enough to do it. I'm very pleased with the emphasis that the new Secretary of State for Education has placed on the need for skills, and that's going to be a crucial area. But let's assume that we can do better in that area than we have historically as a nation, and really get the people that we need, then this is an enormous driver. And we can do so many of these things at home. Indeed, in some odd ways, we'll be benefiting from climate change, because there are quite a number of things we can do at home which we might not have been able to do at home. But we are going to have to handle it very carefully. We're going to be very short of water in some parts of the country. I come from the east of England. When I first was a candidate there in 1975, we had no issue about water. People are now having to use Israeli trickle irrigation. That's the change that has taken place. But I do see the horticultural industry as a very exciting industry, and we will need its products. And the growth of gardening, for all the reasons that you've said, is really important. I think I have I don't want to be controversial, of course, but I think I have three things to say about the horticultural industry. One is it's really got to win the battle with the government about health. We've really got to try to keep out of this country a whole range of diseases, particularly of plants, which arise because of climate change, making it easier. And that does mean we've got to be really tough about that. Secondly, I think it's got to accept that we should ban the use of peat, not in a few years' time, but absolutely immediately. It is nonsense that at the one end we're using public money to restore peatlands, at the other end we still use peat horticulturally, and I think it's got to be stopped. And thirdly, I think as an industry, we've got to recognise that there is, as Sue says, a real public relations job to be done about why this is really a business that actually makes money for Britain, that it's actually a valuable business. I was the first minister to allow there to be an exception to the hosepipe bans for the horticultural industry. Previously, they were caught every time there was a hosepipe ban. But I did have Charles Notcutt in my constituency, and therefore I knew very well exactly what the horticultural industry meant, and he wasn't letting me off the hook. So I take credit for it, but only half of it, because it really was his. We lost a very important horticulturalist when he died. So, yes, this is a big industry which can grow enormously. We should be supplying what we need for the change that we do need for climate change. And we should be using gardeners to remind people of just how big the change has been in Britain. Because no section of the community is more aware of climate change than those of us who actually plant.
Lord Dean, thank you very much. And now, last but not least, I'm going to go to James Barnes, who is the chairman of the Horticultural Trade Association.
Well, thank you. I'm James Barnes. I guess my career has been an eclectic mix of both investment banking and horticulture, but my family has a background in that industry that goes back some 150 years. So it is in my blood. That's not to say I'm qualified to answer huge technical questions on horticulture this evening. But and as Paul said, I currently chair the Horticultural Trades Association. That's a non-for-profit association that represents a very broad church of the industry. I can't compete with Sue in terms of number of years, but as an organisation, we've been around for 120 years, not 200. And we represent nurseries and growers to garden retailers, manufacturers that supply the industry, and landscapers. And I think it's important to mention a point that Sue made there. We represent, yes, some of the big national players, but also some of the smaller family enterprises that do characterise our industry. We are a very fragmented industry, and I think that's actually a strength. As Sue has so eloquently said, we do have a growth strategy that's just been published, but I think the exciting thing there is the extent to that leans into and supports so many of the government's policy areas. And I guess that is the big exciting piece for me. We have an industry here that is twice the size of the fishing industry. It's bigger than aerospace. And I don't want to repeat the metrics that Sue mentioned, but if you grow all of those metrics in terms of GDP, employment, and take to the revenue, then those metrics do become pretty meaningful. And so I think we have a plan that can add substantial economic growth to UK PLC, but it's a plan that also delivers on so many of the government's objectives, and those particularly within the 25-year environment plan. In fact, I go so far as to say that over half of those objectives cannot be delivered without a strong and robust UK horticulture industry. So to that extent, you know, we are an enabler for climate change. And I think it's a plan that is not really about asking for money. It's not asking the Treasury for funds in any huge sense. It's more about a pragmatic flex in current regulation or guidance. And it's about building consistency and it's about building confidence. And I think finally the point I would make is it could be a wonderful example of cross-government inter-industry collaboration and cooperation. And I think from a political point of view, therefore, it's a plan that ticks the climate change box and the economic growth box, and perhaps is the best example of building back greener. I think, like most things in life, there is not one silver bullet. There are clearly a number of asks of both ourselves as the industry and of government to enable this to happen. And I think it's been important to demonstrate that very point, and that the plan that we've published, I think, does that. So there's no huge legislative agenda here, and importantly, no huge ask of Treasury. It's more about removing barriers, removing regulation. But I think that's where we can create a huge win. So I think it's about being pragmatic in terms of policy refinement, and I think it's about building confidence. And that confidence is a very, very powerful weapon for businesses. And it will only take a little bit of engagement to really start to build on that.
James, thank you very much. I'm now going to go into the kind of Q&A session. And obviously, I will sort of mix and match among the panel. Can I ask all those participating to carry on sending in your questions? We've probably got about 3/4 of an hour. So I thought I'd start off with one of my own as a label, an outsider to this discussion in the following way. I was listening carefully to the contributions, and I started thinking first that the agriculture sector is controversial in some quarters. There are people who are passionately pro the way British agriculture works, and there are other people who are more critical. Then I listened to this conversation about your sector, and these names come out of the screen at me: Wisley, Norcutts, and others. I mean, the Brits are tremendous consumers of this stuff. You know, you'll see them at Norcutts on a Sunday. I go to Wisley, being a southerner, and it's packed out. And you've then gone on to make the point about all these various government departments that you think you've got a legitimate interest in. I mean, everything from the Secretary of State's to mental health and health. So the question I'm working my way to is, there seems to be, as a layman, tremendous public support for your sector here, potentially there. What more do you think you can do to mobilise it if you're going to achieve the potential of these jobs and this output that Sue began by describing? So, Sue, can I start with you?
Yeah, I think one of the great things is that the industry is very much together and behind this. I think it was very interesting what Secretary of State had to say, but most of that really was more to do with the countryside and agriculture. And I think we really need to distinguish between horticulture and agriculture. Although it's all planticulture, there is a difference between those two industries. And I think if we can get, I've always viewed it a bit like a daisy chain, really. Apologies for the horticultural bit there. But I do think that, you know, we have a great relationship with DEFRA, and particularly on the all important plant health and pests, we work really well together. But I think, you know, if they can look, tie us in, and together we have a meeting with them and education so we can get the green skills crisis sorted out, and then education we can link on to health and get both the education and skills and mental health coming from that and careers for people. I don't think we have it in our power. And I don't know, James, I think I may be a bit unpopular in OHRG for saying this, but I don't think we have it in our power to actually be able to force the government departments to talk together. But if we don't use what James said, use this as an example of cross-departmental working, I fear we will never get the benefit from horticulture that we could. And as Lord Deben said, you know, there are 30 million people ready and willing to actually help this country in its climate change crisis and import substitution and all the other many things that are in that report if anybody had a moment to read it. So I don't wish to pass the book, but I do think we are very, very willing to meet and talk at any moment, at any time. But we need that to be instigated by government if they believe in this, in our industry. And for someone who is believes that we can, between us in the industry, generate 42 billion, I just think it's not right that we're not being enabled to do that. So I really hope that tonight maybe can instigate something really different. It would be great to have a round table of the departments, whether it's ministers, secretary of state, civil servants. James and I and the rest of OHRG won't mind. We just really want to get action and really try and make a difference for the UK.
Right, I'll just go next to Lord Devon, because you were a politician as well as a businessman. Indeed, you're now in the Lords. Am I making any sense when I talk about the potential support that's there in terms of the public and what might be done with it? I think he needs to.
You've mooted me. I think so, and I do think the horticultural industry has stepped up to the mark in a remarkable way during lockdown. Its growth of really interesting innovation of being able to use mail order and such like in a way that they hadn't before has been really, really very effective. I wonder whether it isn't that we just have got to get ministers, George is an exception, actually, but most ministers don't see this as a serious industry. And I think we have to overcome that. And the truth is, one just has to go on and on about it, that this is not just something on the edge. It is actually a major industry. In fact, it's much more important than the fishing industry. I mean, it really is much bigger, employs much more people, and it's more important to our economy. And yet we actually have four fisheries ministers. I've never quite understood why it is we can't gather just how important the horticultural industry is. And I do think we need to make sure that Bayes has as much interest in this as DEFRA, because it does span those two. And of course, we share quite a number of the problems of agriculture. I mean, I am in a small way a farmer, and I recognise that the problems we have about labour and skills are going to be with us for some long time. I think we also have to say to the Secretary of State that although he can't say it, I can say that his battle to make sure that people aren't unfairly competed against by our trade arrangements is hugely important. And it's just as important for the horticultural trades, because if we're going to ask British horticulture to meet higher standards, then it isn't right that they should then be undermined by imports which are done at a different level. And climate change does demand that we take seriously the issue of climate change when it comes to our trade arrangements. So the Department of International Trade needs to be part of this.
James, if you'd like to come in.
Yes, thank you. I think it is a question of recognition, and I think the points made about size and scale and what we can do around all of those ambitions on the climate change agenda are two of the most critical things, but it is about getting that message out there. And one of the things that Sue and myself and others in the industry have been debating about is whether we look to change our name from ornamental horticulture to environmental horticulture, because it's this word ornamental that means sort of decorative or cosmetic and not useful, that I think somehow pulls us back in terms of that recognition process. And if we had the word environmental in front of us, which is effectively, in horticultural terms, the art and science of improving the quality of life by planting gardens and plants and trees, would that not be a better way of raising our profile? So that's something I just throw out there. But I think it is about recognition. And if we can get that recognition cross-departmentally within government about the scale and size and how we can lean into helping a lot of these issues on the climate change agenda, then I think that's what we need to do.
Of course, that's a queue of questions and points waiting for the Secretary of State to answer. So, George, over to you.
Well, thanks, Paul. And as you know, as John alluded to, I'm somebody who does very much value horticulture because I studied commercial horticulture at college. I spent a year working on a Harding ornamental nursery stock business in Worcestershire called Bransford Nurseries in the day. I spent a lot of time learning to bud roses and ornamental trees and everything else in between. And we do have some sort of, you know, great names associated with horticulture. You know, it's not just Knockcuts that John referred to, but also the Hillier family going back, you know, decades or even centuries. And then, of course, we've got some great institutions like, you know, Kew Gardens, which is, you know, supported by DEFRA, has got international reach. I come from Cornwall, and the Eden Project's been a fantastic innovation again with global significance now. So I think we've got, you know, we should recognise the international reach and prowess that we have in this space. But coming to the, you know, two points that have been raised, one is around trade. The truth is that, you know, as a result really of joining the European Union and the development of the single market, and the inevitable process of what was called economic specialization by those who advocated such things, we've you know, we basically offshored a lot of our domestic plant production to the Netherlands principally, and a lot of our nursery stock and also commercial plant production, things like strawberry plants that, you know, used to be mainly produced in places like Norfolk, now predominantly imported from the Netherlands. We've moved to a model where we import most of that plant material. And the interesting question is the extent to which that may now change, because even though we have obviously a tariff-free trade agreement with the EU, there will be non-tariff barriers. And those are not insignificant when you look at the issue of plant health, and not for good reason. You know, the Xylella is a major threat at the moment, our biggest plant health threat, affecting multiple species. It's present in the European Union. There is a risk that we would get it here in the UK. And that means we have to be ever vigilant. And so what we will now have the ability to do is to increase the levels of biosecurity checks that we have on imported plants. And that's likely to lead to a degree of onshoring of that hardy ornamental nursery stock production. The second area is around learning, and Sue mentioned this. The RHS actually runs some very good schemes, giving grants to schools, primary schools predominantly, to put in place greenhouses for, you know, school children to learn how to grow things. DEFRA's got a scheme of its own that we have been funding along with the Department for Education, which is around nature-based learning. And I visited a brilliant project a couple of months ago that was that was a special school, in fact, but all about developing sensory areas outside, using nature, using plants as a means of interacting, you know, with children needing that sensory stimulation because they had learning disabilities. And there's a lot else that's been done besides on that with mainstream schools as well. Now, that's a scheme, and John, as a former government minister, will be familiar with this. It's one that DEFRA has to keep, you know, endlessly fighting to keep going, and to get other departments to chip in their share. I always have this challenge in Whitehall that where there's a fund that's funded by several departments, officials in other departments will often offer it up to their officials or to their ministers as an easy way to save money, just cut this. And we always have to work to make sure that we keep that partnership with other departments. But to answer Sue's question, we do very much put the work into keeping that that partnership running, particularly on that particular nature-based learning grant scheme that we've been running for a number of years. Now, Paul, as a former member of this place, you'll also recognise the bell going off in the background, which is our cue to have to disappear. So I may have to drop out, but I will try and rejoin in about 10 minutes, if that's OK.
Well, of course, you can't miss a vote. We know how angry the whips will be in these rather charged conditions. So I hope to see you again in about 10 minutes. And now I'm going to go, since we've got half an hour left, I'm going to go straight to the Q&A questions. What I'm going to do is to really just sort of fire them at one person and not necessarily go around the panel because it takes too long, but anyone who wants to come in is very welcome to do so. So the first question I have in front of me is from Susan Carey, who asks, how do we encourage tree establishment rather than random trees just planted and then left? How do we secure wildlife corridors, not just lollipop trees? And how do we ensure biosecurity? Your Diva, any thoughts on this?
Well, I think she's so right to raise these issues. I mean, we shouldn't be supporting tree planting. We should be supporting the continuance of trees, the looking after of trees. That's what's really important. Trouble with tree planting, when we used to do it in that sort of way, is people planted and then forgot all about it. That's not what we want at all. We need the establishment of trees. Wildlife corridors is a question of putting back the many of the hedges which we have taken out. I've put back all the hedges in part of our farm. Now we've got some more land and we're putting back as much as we possibly can, certainly half of them, which will give wildlife corridors. And of course, new developments in agriculture, particularly as we move to much more robotics, will make it much easier to have the sort of fields which are smaller but with hedges. And that's crucially important, and the horticultural industry is very important for doing that. So I believe that many of the changes which the Department of DEFRA has actually put forward will be very helpful, if only they would do the whole lot together and do the details. Sorry, George isn't here to say that, but the fact of the matter is farmers don't have the opportunities to make these choices at the moment because they don't know the details of the whole range of things. We need to have that first, and the details must talk about looking after the trees after you've planted them.
Sewell James, do either of you want to come in here?
Yeah, I would love to beg that when we talk about tree planting and wildlife corridors, it isn't just through countryside. It's massively important that. But, you know, we're getting an ever more urban population and we need to get the wildlife corridors going through urban settlements as well. And so I would really encourage to the lady who asked the question, you're absolutely right. You know, a few whips planted in the countryside are going to die very quickly. But a small tree planted in an urban garden, if everyone in a street, if everyone in a village, if everyone in a town, if everyone in a city plants one and does other things that, you know, I think most gardeners would know how to encourage wildlife into their gardens. We could make a massive difference. You know, wildlife and pollinators, they need through the whole country, not just the countryside. And without wishing to get on at another department, I think it's vital that the planners and the developers understand this so that we have more garden space in our urban populations, because there is no space for wildlife in the way housing is being built in many areas at the moment.
Well, I was just lip reading you there. I think that was an invitation to me to comment. So that, I would back up what Sue said. I think one of the key discussions we want to have with government is about how we can influence the planning system to create more green spaces, whether that's new housing developments or even within our existing urban spaces for exactly that, for trees. And I think I would be encouraging all forms of tree planting, whether it's lone standalone trees. In fact, I think the great thing is, you know, that standalone tree, that one mature oak tree can give off enough oxygen for two people to live off and absorbs 40 pounds of carbon a year, as well as supporting one of the biggest ecosystems that we know of in nature. So that one lone oak tree, done multiple times, can make a huge, huge difference.
Okay, I'm going to go to the next question, which in fact comes from Baroness Fuchs, who, as you all know, but perhaps not everyone participating in this event will, is co-chair of the Gardening and Horticulture APPG. And she asks this, she says, on alternatives to peat, what do we know that DEFRA is doing to find alternatives to peat of a sufficient quality and quantity to deal with the needs of professional growers, as opposed to peat alternatives in garden centres for amateur gardens? Now, we've not got the Secretary of State here, and I'm well aware that Lord Deben's already drawn attention to the subject of peat, but some of you may have a sense of what the department's up to and what more it could do. So, James, you're nodding, so I'm going to go straight back to you.
Yeah, well, thank you. I mean, it is a very emotive subject, but I think the Baroness raises a very good question, because the Horticultural Initiative actually is pretty joined up in terms of where they want to be on this issue and in terms of the eradication of peat. I think there is a question in terms of timing, and that may be frustrating to some, but there is a huge willingness to change here. But I think there is a genuine issue about how we get there and what the availability of these alternatives are. Now, I think there are some very exciting prospects out there, but it does require government to work with us to get access to those. It does mean bringing in some of the major utility companies into this equation about how we can utilise waste, how we can change some of the legislation around end of waste. And those things will start to make a major difference. And it's vitally important we do that.
Sue or John, anything else to add? I know John's already had a go on, Pete. I don't know if you...
Well, I'll be very quick. I just want to say I entirely agree with James. But my experience always is that what you have to do is say we're going to stop it. And when you stop it, you get a business. People then pile in to sell the alternatives. You've got to do that. But what James says is right. The government has not got its mind round the whole issue of waste. Much of the waste that we have can be used in these circumstances. But at the moment, the legislation is both contradictory and out of date. And we need to move much faster on this. And again, it's one of those problems, which is that for some reason or other, you can't get ministers to see how important this is. And it's not just DEFRA, it's BEIS and it's the Department of Health. They've all got to get together and see how important this is. And it's crucially important for the utilities too, and for farmers. Because if you want to have less use of artificial fertilisers, you've really got to use the waste material that we have from our sewage plants and such like. So you've really got to get this going. And once again, we have to take it seriously.
Yeah, and I would just add on the export of... at the moment, we've got really counterintuitive or counterproductive legislation, because to export British grown plants at the moment, they've got to be exported in pure peat or coir. And I mean, that's just bonkers. You know, you're absolutely right, Lord Deben, that, you know, once it's been announced, I mean, at the RHS, we stopped selling peat in retail several years ago and have declared that we will have no peat usage in 25. But for that to work, you know, that there are companies that are already working on wood-based peat alternatives, but they can't use it if they want to sell their plants anywhere overseas. So if that would be my one plea on peat-free, if we can try and get the legislation sorted out so that, you know, we can have the ability to export UK-grown plants in peat-free growing media. It just seems bonkers when it's a government target and yet you have to use peat to be able to export it.
Which brings me to the Secretary of State, who, that was a remarkably quick vote, I have to say, but you're back to answer a question that was really directed at you, really, in your absence, from Baroness Fuchs, the chair of the All Party Group, and you've heard bits of other responses to it, which is really what's the department doing to encourage and bring about alternatives to peat?
Well, there's been quite a change. So we've had a consultation that we launched a few months ago, which is about banning the commercial sale of peat in the amateur sector. And the truth is that still around 80% of all of the peat that is used is sadly just sold in big bags in garden centres that people effectively use as a soil improver. And there are better soil improvers, you know, horse manure, other farmyard manures that are also sold. And it's really just, you know, a lack of knowledge that makes people think that that using peat is a soil improver. And it's quite a wasteful way to use the product. So we are going to ban the sale of it in the amateur sector. And we've set a target to do that by 2024. And we've consulted on that already, and we'll be working on a legislative vehicle to bring that forward. And we've also signalled that we intend to ban it more widely in the commercial sector a little bit later, probably in 2028. And the reason we've gone later on the commercial sector is there are areas such as, you know, the areas of horticulture and producing plugs, for instance, for the vegetable industry, where it's actually harder to use the alternatives. There are some sectors like the strawberry sector where they've made some quite good progress to move away from peat grow bags to grow bags based entirely on coir, and that's really good progress, you know, real innovation being shown there. And there are other bark-based substitutes and waste-based substitutes that could be used. But all the points that have been made around the need to strike down regulatory obstacles and barriers to that are perfectly valid ones. And obviously we need to do that along the way as well to make sure that those alternatives can be used.
I'm going to go to the next question, which is from Jonathan Shepherd, who says, here we go, as a life member of the RHS, holder of two national plant collections, I'm aware of the important green spaces that we have. Many years ago, Res Publica did a report on the right to beauty. Recent polling show that in terms of levelling up, the immediate thing that voters wanted was some sort of restoration in terms of civic pride. What work, he asks, is being done to engage MPs in red wall areas about what horticulture can do there? Secretary of State, I'll start with you.
Yeah, well, so we've got our the England Tree Strategy, and there are components in there that are very much around supporting local authorities to plant trees in the urban environment. And to, you know, that can be individual trees or landscaped areas. So there's one part of that. But also we have the Levelling Up white paper that's coming from Michael Gove's department later this week. And I think you can expect to see quite a bit on that in there, in that we've already announced our intention to have local nature recovery strategies where we designate new areas for local nature reserves in particular localities, but also biodiversity net gain that's going to try to basically hardwire nature into the design of new construction, new build estates, and where that's not possible to make space for nature in and around them. So it's absolutely a key part of Pride in Place, which is itself identified as a major component of the Prime Minister's Levelling Up strategy. And I think you'll see a bit more about this on Wednesday when that white paper is published.
Anyone else on levelling up on the red wall and horticulture? You had Sue's hands going up.
Yeah, I think it's a really good question, and we're doing, so thank you for being a member and all the rest of that, but it's great of the Red Wall. So, for example, we worked very closely with local authority in Salford to open up Bridgewater there, which is 164-acre garden, and that's got obviously trees in that, but also a whole variety of both native trees and non-natives to really make sure that we get biodiversity coming into there. But also to the local pride area, Britain in Bloom is Europe's biggest community gardening And I would invite all of you to come to a Britain in Bloom group, because if you want to see local pride and take there, we give them mainly really quite small grants. And from those small grants, I mean, sometimes less than £1,000, they can really transform their community. So I hope, you know, both those of us in the industry and also local government, that we can work more and more in partnership to really be able to deliver not only joyful beauty, but also help the mental health crisis and the environment.
Anyone in the country file this week will have seen what Durham has done along the coast in the most polluted areas, where you really did have all the remains of the coal industry. And all over the country, local authorities have been, I think, particularly good at doing this. And one of the things I hope the government will understand, and in the levelling up plan will accept, is that we do need to have better partnership between central and local government. We won't meet the climate change demands. We won't really do what needs to be done for levelling up unless we can recover a proper relationship between central government and local government. And it seems to me this is a very, very important role. And I would have thought something which both the Secretary of State for DEFRA and Michael Gove would actually want to do. I think we've got to get away from the historic situation and build a new relationship.
James, anything on levelling up, or do you want to pass?
No, I was just going to just make the point that the horticultural industry is widely spread throughout the United Kingdom. I'm sure the Secretary of State will be aware that, you know, there are big businesses in Cornwall, in Lincolnshire, in Lancashire, and indeed north of the border in Scotland. But so from that point of view, that whole growth agenda does lend itself to spreading economic development and economic growth throughout the United Kingdom.
Okay, we'll go to the next question, which is from Jeanette Towey, who asks, how can we stop nurseries and garden centres being sold off for housing? Here in Sussex, three of those within 3 miles of where I live have become development sites. This means a loss of jobs and a loss of facilities for locals. Sue? Hello? Sue.
Sorry, Paul. Sorry, yes, sorry, I must have coughed when you said Sue.
Yes, quite. Did you get the question?
I think I did, or at least yes. The gist of it, yes, before I broke it to cost.
Fine.
I think, funnily enough, I was in Sussex last weekend and I saw several down by Chichester Way having been sold off. And I hope, and I have to admit, I don't know enough about local planning regulations, but I really hope that we can do something to ensure that green sites that are there, not only to provide jobs, but, you know, I think it was Lord Deben said earlier, you know, this is a real crisis upon us that we've got to take seriously and really make sure that those bodies, whether they're nurseries, whether they're skilled horticulturists, we need them for this country. And, you know, I think before it's too late, some of these nurseries have been growing plants on for years. It's not like any other industry where you can just make something again quickly. So before we lose the talent, before we lose the skills, I really do think that we need to take this seriously and find a way to prevent the sale of those.
James, you've got your hand up, so you want to come in, yes?
Yeah, I suppose I can speak from some experience here because my formative career was with Dobby's Garden Centres. And I think, to be brutally honest, if you ran a successful garden centre, it was more valuable as a retail garden centre than it ever was for any alternative planning use. So in my experience, very few of those sites were ever sold for redevelopment. It's about the success of the business that's really where the true value is.
But I think it's the skills level, James, that there's a lot of those. I know from the exhibitors at Chelsea and our other shows, they've had to sell their business because they can't find enough staff. If they don't have their own children who will follow on in the business, there's not enough training going on of horticultural staff in the country. So they have to often sell it and close down because they're getting older and they can't afford, they can't run it themselves. So I think that does lead back as well to the green skills crisis.
Secretary of State.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question. I would separate it from the issue of skills in the sense that if you go to somewhere like Thanet Earth or Wisbeach, where British Sugar have got a major glasshouse project, you actually find that they can attract skills, and they will often attract skills from overseas as well as domestically. There is a sort of moot point with some of these older nurseries if they've got kind of old-fashioned, very wide-span 1960s type of greenhouses that are very expensive to heat. They might not actually be, you know, necessarily the right type of glass to keep. And you know, it may well make commercial sense, to be honest, if they're in an urban environment where there's housing, it may well make sense to develop them, but to build you know, brand new fit for purpose glass somewhere else. So I don't think we should, you know, as conservatives who believe that sometimes there's a case for change, but though we're conservatives and don't always like it, we shouldn't always see the sale of an old site that might not any further serve the purpose as being necessarily bad and necessarily representing a decline in the industry, provided we are seeing that construction of new modern glass and a pipeline of new skilled people coming into to work there. I mean, we are looking to support some of the what we call sort of peri-urban community projects, of which there's a growing number, some of them quite, you know, they're quite a lot of local support where you get communities coming together on box schemes and so on, and often taking small areas of land from the local authority to produce that. They're quite popular, and it's the kind of thing where we're open to supporting more, because it gives communities a connection with their food again.
Can I just agree with that? Because I think the danger is that what happens is that the garden centre, which is in the town and gives that very important green space, then finds it can make a lot more money by doing very simply. James is absolutely right, but if you move your business outside, you may well still be profitable as a business, but you sell that land for housing. What you've done is to change the nature of the area. All I think is that we should have a bias towards saying no to changing it. We should be thinking all the time that open spaces, commercial places which are open within towns, you need to try to defend, because simply what we have learned is that both from a climate change point of view, because of the effect it does have on the local area and air, but also from a mental health point of view, that you don't want to lose these places. And so I think that one just has to have a bias towards saying no for the development of these sites if they're in the middle of towns.
Okay, we're moving towards the end. I have a question here from familiar names, as Nick Wood Dow. It's actually not a bad way of moving towards the end, who says, I started the Tory Green Initiative with John, then I became chairman of Spelthorne in Blue with Sue. George has always been a supporter of green activity. How much more can government do to stimulate green growth and more gardening at a very local level to achieve change? And my writer to this question is all about skills, because one subject that's kept coming up during the evening is this skills gap. So who wants to come in first? Maybe James.
Certainly. I mean, I think that is a key constraint on our industry. But I think, Sue, perhaps you, I think you're better qualified than me to speak about that. So with your permission, Paul, I think that would be a better way of answering the question.
Very good. Sue, then.
Yeah, I think, I mean, those who are as old as me will remember when local authorities actually had great involvement in civic bedding and planting and all the rest of it to make communities have real pride in that. And I would really hope, I mean, I feel very sorry for the local authorities because they have budget cuts all over the place. But I would hope that investment is made. You know, horticulture doesn't need huge amount of investment. It can be done in really quite low level compared to some other budgets. And I think if we put together some small amount of, if every local authority in the country had a green budget for horticulture and the skills was put back into schools so that there was more knowledge about plants, I honestly think that the horticulture industry would go from strength to strength, local communities would go from strength to strength, mental health would improve. And it's not really to do with money, any of this. This is much more to do with a joined up will to make a change.
Lord Deben.
Well, I just think that we've just got to do it better. First of all, the links between universities, land-based colleges and the and local authorities are appalling. And they really don't use these opportunities in the way that they should. There's a real role, I think, for the Department of Education to work with the Department of Local Government, Michael Gove's department, to try to make a much better, closer relationship so that we can actually train people. And I think we do have to have something of a public relations campaign in schools, because I'm afraid people don't take this industry in the way it ought to be taken, where there are real opportunities, real chances for young people. And it's not just a place that people go to because they can't do anything else, which is how sometimes schools treat it. It's a place which really has fantastic challenges for bright people to think their way through. And I'm very impressed with the work that is done by the BBC in particular. The BBC is hugely important here. It's done some wonderful work just showing how remarkable the horticultural industry can be in a scientific sense. And I'd like to see that recognised much more effectively by government.
And finally, Secretary of State, it's over to you in the light of, you know, Lord Deben's comments that the links between local businesses and the colleges and local authorities, well, I think his word was appalling.
Well, look, I think he's got a good point, and I'll come to that. First of all, Nick has been involved in environmental issues in the party for a very, very long time. In fact, I think he was involved in the policy group, as we call them back in the day, that John co-chaired with Zach, if my memory serves me right, many, many moons ago. And look, I think the thing I'd say is we've never had as much emphasis and focus on our natural environment as we do now as a party in government. And I think the things that we're doing on, you know, requiring local nature recovery strategies of every local authority, introducing the concept of biodiversity net gain is probably going to bring about £200 million a year through local authorities to support nature. And then actually, we've already made available funding so that local authorities can hire ecologists, the ecologists that they'll need to do this job properly. I think all of that's going to be an important step change. And when it comes to skills, I think there's a, you know, there's a danger here that we sort of, and all my time, we sort of wring our hands worrying that not enough people are studying horticulture. The key thing to get them to study it is to make it, you know, more attractive, more positive, and better paid. And I think we're getting there in that interest in nature, in working outdoors, I think it's never been higher, in that it's not for young people leaving school or college these days, they don't actually just want to go and get a job working in the city. They actually, there's a bit of them that wants to do something that means something that's worthwhile. And I think increasingly they will be seeking work in the sort of environmental sciences and in this sector. And then the other key thing is to make it attractive enough. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, the reason they haven't in recent decades have problems at attracting talent to the city is that they paid a lot of money. And so if we can get to the point that this is a career path that's valued, both financially as well as being a career that people choose because it's got something worthwhile about it. So it hasn't got to be paying quite the same as the city in order to attract people. I think you will start to get people studying it, choosing it as a career, and then, you know, things develop a life of their own without us having to have endless government skill strategies, which I've seen multiple versions of in my own time.
Well, Secretary of State, thank you very much. And sadly, that's all we've got time for. So I have some apologies and thanks. I want to apologise to all the potential questioners who couldn't get in because time is necessarily limited. I want to give very warm thanks to Conservative Home's partner in this event, the Horticultural Trades Association. And of course, finally, thanks to all of you, Secretary of State, for keeping coming back despite all the voting and other interruptions this evening. And many thanks to Lord Deeb and Sue and James. I've learnt an enormous amount about the vibrancy of the sector and the way in which it really does apply its work across government departments, and hope to hear more about it in the future. So thank you all very much.
Yeah.